Hey, this is Adam White. Welcome to the Punk News Podcast. John, you end up writing a lot of obituaries on Punk News.
Yeah, and unfortunately, this one hit too close. They all hit too close to home for someone, but for us, this one hit too close to home, and it's a real sad week of Punk News.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy, or it's not easy, but it's easier sometimes when you're writing about an artist because you can have that... You can maintain that level of detachment where you can say that, you know what, I'm in the audience and they're a performer and we're not peers. We're not on the same level, but we can't do that this time. So the sad news, if you haven't seen it on the site or in, I think, countless places online at this point, is that a former Punk News contributor, former editor, writer, podcast participant, Brittany Strummer, has died. And we really weren't sure how to handle this on the site because we didn't want to just go and write, you know, a little 2-paragraph obit because Brittany had way more of an impact on us personally than that. So we opened it up to the community. So if you head over to Punk News, the article is called "For Brittany Strummer," and we have. God, there's got to be at least 24, maybe more, messages from her friends and people she worked with on the site, people she met online, people she was going to shows with in Denver. We have messages there from Mike Park and Brendan Kelly and Miguel from Teenage Bottle Rocket and a handful of other people that you may know. Some past Punk News editors, guys that were involved before, but, you know, have since moved on, have kind of come back to give their stories. You can find messages there from Brian Yancey and from Mondo Olivas and Britt Reiser and Chris Moran and all kinds of other people that you may recognize from Punk News. So this is tough for all of us, and it's going to be a little bit of a weird show because we are going to somehow awkwardly transition into doing our normal silly thing on here. But yeah, so rest in peace to Brittany Strummer. We're all going to miss her and her enthusiasm for bands like The Clash and None More Black and Against Me and all Dillinger Four. So much of what we consider orgcore just defined a big part of the Punk News realm, I guess. So I don't know what else to say, John. What do we do?
I guess what we do is what everyone is doing right now, and it's a testament to Britney's cat. I mean, really, listen, a lot of the people at Punk News, you know, they got good qualities, they got bad qualities. Britney, everybody loved. I don't know a single person that didn't like Britney, and pretty much everyone that knew Britney loved Britney. And if you go on to the Punk News the Punk News comment section or the Westworld news article or even the GoFundMe set up in her memory, Adam, it's crazy the amount of people that she touched and influenced. And the only thing that we can do, I guess, is just share positive memories about her and remember that and keep her in our thoughts and keep her family in our thoughts. I mean, that's all we can do, you know. And it's sad, and it's a tragedy, and there's no silver lining. There's no way to sugarcoat it. It's a sad week, month, year, decade at Punk News for sure.
Right. So, I mean, Brittany's thing was that she was absolutely enthusiastic. She was infectiously enthusiastic about punk rock. She loved this genre like with a depth that I've never experienced from anyone else. I mean, she was in love with punk rock in a way that was really something else. And she was in love with The Clash and in love with Joe Strummer. So that's, you know, we have no better way to intro in this episode of the podcast except to rock a little Clash. So here we go.
King.
All right, this is Punk News Podcast 439. Once again, I'm Adam White, recording for you here in my basement in Niagara Falls, Ontario. Joining me on tonight's show, Mr. John Gentile out of Philly. That wasn't meant rhyme. Was not meant to rhyme.
That sounds so good, though.
It's such a slippery slope of rhyming. And you also heard Ally Bullitt there in New York, Brooklyn, Queens. I don't know.
Queens.
There we go. It was in a Beastie Boys song, so I know what it's called. So we got a whole bunch of stuff to talk about this week. Some big news came up, the Fest lineup, some really cool stuff from one of John's favorite bands, the sound of me knocking a highlighter over onto my speaker, all kinds of crazy things like that. Before we get to there, this is a bad sign for this show. Before we get to that, John, is there any mail?
Yes, you can always just add podcast at podcast@punknews.org. That's how you can reach us. This is from Nick. Nick says, "Hey guys, longtime follower of Punk News, more recent listener of the podcast. I've been getting through the backlog and have a two-parter for you. Number one, good discussion about the bigger bands, Rancid and NoFX, playing to larger size venues like House of Blues. I would rather see bands play smaller club shows for a more intimate experience, but do some of these bands even have a choice? By playing a House of Blues size venue, they are allowing for the most fans to attend their shows. If NoFX were to book a small club show, wouldn't they be leaving out a ton of fans because it would sell out immediately? Point number two from Nick, I couldn't agree more about encores. If you're going to do an encore, make it interesting and make it a rare song or a cover. Otherwise, it has gotten pretty boring waiting for the band to come back out and play songs that we all knew they were going to play anyway. A few years ago, I saw the Melvins here in Boston, and they just had a loud ringing noise for 10 minutes while the crowd just stood there. While it wasn't too sonically pleasing, it was still different and memorable. Keep up the good work from Nick."
I'm going to be selfish and say I want the bigger bands to solve that problem for me. Like, if it's going to make a whole bunch of people's, you know, whole years that a band like, say, like NoFX or Bad Religion, you know, shows up and plays some smaller venue in their town, and they somehow pull that off. And I don't know exactly what that means. That whether it's a, you know, whether it's a secret show or a series of secret shows or a residency or something, right? Like, you can make that work. And I understand it's logistically difficult, and there's reasons why these bands don't do it. But whatever, I'm going to be selfish and say, to me, it would be truly special as an audience member to get that more intimate experience out of it.
Yeah. I mean, I miss, you know, there's bands that you watch get bigger over the years, but you remember the days when you saw them in a tiny club, and it's hard to have the same enthusiasm for them but with a lot of those bigger bands, sorry to be the old person bringing in the old person's perspective, but you know, a lot of those bigger bands, like, they've been around a long time. Like, they probably have families or some other shit going on at home that they're trying to attend to. So it's like, there's also just the time and the money efficiency of just being able to, like, hit big venues, know that the people that really, really want to see you are going to get to see you, and then you get to go home. Sorry, that's like such a grandma perspective.
No, but that is the right perspective, because I mean, as someone that, like, increasingly has trouble getting to any show that isn't 20 minutes away and done by 11:30, I'm I can feel for the other side of that. But that makes me wonder why something like, say, a residency wouldn't work in that situation. So, you know what? You don't have to travel around in a band or in a van. You go, you know, you get a nice hotel room in, you know, Philadelphia for 5 straight days, and you play, you know, a bunch of little shows where they're all going to sell out, but, you know, there's enough of the shows that the people who want to go can get spread out between them. I mean, that screws you, I guess, if you're not in Philadelphia or willing to travel there. So this isn't really great for anyone. This is not a good solution show so far, John.
Well, you know, who's doing that literally right now is Peter Murphy of Bauhaus, although I'm going to take maybe somewhat of a contrarian position. I do agree that often the smaller show is better. I'm trying to think of some, like when I saw Flag at like a 300 or 400 like pack, like cap venue, it was amazing. That being said, I think some shows actually might be bigger in medium-sized venues. I saw Peter Murphy in about a 2,000, 3,000 size venue. It was Peter Murphy and David J. of Bauhaus doing all Bauhaus. And I'm not sure it would have been as effective in a small club just because the base is so essential to Bauhaus. And it was just at the big clubs, you know, the base radiates through the room. And so it was small enough that you could see Peter Murphy. He wasn't that far away, like, you know, like at like a stadium or whatever. But it was big enough that he was getting paid and tickets were reasonable. And I guess the same with when I saw Peter Hook do all Joy Division, like it was in the that club in San Francisco that I think just closed down, the mezzanine in San Francisco. Peter Murphy's bass is essential to Joy Division. And like the mezzanine is almost all metal, or it was. And so when he would play, it would like shake the room, and it was really cool. So I don't know. I agree that the small club show is cool, but on the other hand, if the difference is a band barely scraping by at the small club show or making a comfortable living at the club show, at the 3,000, 2,000 capacity, I'm cool with that. And well, actually, I saw Gwar at like a 400 capacity thing and like a 5,000 capacity thing, and Gwar honestly might be better at like a 5,000 capacity thing just because it's Gwar. I don't know. Anyways, this is from Nils. Nils says the following: I've heard you all talk about the Beastie Boys on the podcast before. I think you saw that they are doing a spoken word engagement. I wanted to go, but tickets were $100 each. Would you spend $100 to go to a spoken word engagement, even if it was the Beastie Boys? From Nils.
I have deep emotional scarring from having missed Beastie Boys performances, and which I will forever miss because they are now no longer ever going to happen. I had fucking tickets to the Rhyme and Reason tour. You remember that one?
Was it Rage Against the Machine?
It was them and Rage Against the Machine, and they made like a little like festival out of it, and then he fucking fell off his bike, and then that was it. It was canceled, and then, you know, nothing ever recovered from that. So yeah, I in most cases I don't think I would pay $100 to see. I probably wouldn't pay $100 to go see one of my dead relatives come back to life and talk, but I would maybe spend $100 to go see the Beastie Boys talk. I think that's my exception.
They have a way of pulling things off. Like, whatever your feelings about spoken word, I do have some faith that if you went to see the Beastie Boys do it, it would end up being something like worthwhile and cool and something you were glad you were at.
I saw the Beastie Boys twice. I saw them on the Hello Nasty tour and the 2 to 5 Boroughs tour. And they were amazing. It was one of the greatest shows I ever saw, Adam and Hallie. It was amazing. I believe it was for the 2 to 5 Boroughs tour. They came out, they did a hip-hop set. Then they did a rock slash, not calypso, like jazz set. And then they did another hip-hop set after that. And not only that, the show opened with a dog show. Like they didn't even have an opening band. The opening was a dog show, which was hilarious. So the Beastie Boys are amazing. I would go to this. I mean, $100 for a spoken word, that's a lot. I agree. That being said, I mean, in a way, you're like, well, at least I'll get a touch of the Beastie Boys because they're not going to come around anymore. And maybe that's worth $100, you know? So I still got to get that book. I mean, it's like $50, which is kind of expensive for a book. But if there's any book worth $50, it's probably the Beastie Boys book, I got to say. So anyways.
Everyone that owns that book is in love with it.
Yeah, yeah. So anyways, I would go. Would I spend $100 to see Keith Morris do spoken word? I probably would. Would I spend $100 to see Henry Rollins do spoken word? Probably not. So it all just comes down to how big of a fan you are, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you can bend and make $100. You could justify $100 for an evening of entertainment because you can just, you know, you can do that, that rationalizing where you say like, well, if we went out for dinner beforehand and then went to the show and then we took a cab and blah, blah, blah. You add all that up, it's $100. So maybe if we just don't do 3/4 of that, then, you know.
See how I rationalize is like, oh, maybe they'll have rare merch, in which case if I buy it, I'm saving myself money as opposed to paying triple four on Discogs years later.
That is not a wise financial justification of anything.
As always, you can reach that podcast at punknews.org. We love getting your mail. Send it from jail. It's never stale.
But yeah, don't drink all right. Ale in jail. We're not going to song transition out of the mail this time. So we're just going to awkwardly stumble over John's wordsmithing to get into some of the stuff that's going on this week. So
would you say my wordsmithing was frail? Did it pale in comparison to the Beastie Boys? And they're
the fact that you're doing this coming off a Beastie Boys story makes it worse. So dig yourself out of the hole and talk about this cool show.
All right, man. Listen, I'm throwing a cool show, man. I'll tell you, I've gotten a taste and I can't stop myself. I just threw a show on March 22nd, and I'm throwing one on May 4th, and then I'm throwing a biggie on June 1, and then we're throwing a biggie at the end of the summer, Summer Soiree 3. But before then, June 1, Stizza Cracked, backed by Crazy in the Brains, Danbert Novakan of Chumbawamba with his new group, Roadkiller, which is thrash from Australia, and also Crazy in the Brains, of course, doing their own set. It's called the Summer Chimera, and I don't think anybody got the metaphor whatsoever, but that's all right. And it's going to be an awesome show. It's June 1 in Philadelphia, and I am pumped. If it's anything like the Stizza Joe Jack Talcum show from last year, it's going to be phenomenal. I think it will. Well, listen, Stizza and Crazy in the Brains last year was it was so amazing in that like they did Choking Victim and Leftover Crack, but they were like unique versions. And I think pretty much everybody that actually appreciated that they were unique, interesting versions. Crazy in the Brains, we'll talk about Crazy in the Brains in a minute. But also Danbert Novakan of Chumbawamba. This is why punk rock is the best, people. Let me tell you. Like so many bands, well, not so many, some bands, they're kind of known and we're like, oh, we love you. And they're like, oh, thanks. And they get known and they kind of disappear. You know what I mean? And I understand that. Not everybody needs to be, quote, punk rock forever. You know what I mean? And not being punk rock isn't a sin, if you will. That being said, Danbert Novakan of Chumbawamba. A lot of people might not know. Chumbawamba had Tough Thumper, which was a gigantic, gigantic international hit. Before then, after then, and during then, though, Chumbawamba was actually one of the first anarcho-punk bands. Of course, the first were, you know, Crass, Rudimentary Peni, Amoebix. But right around, the second wave, you know, Conflict. Signings, Warheads, even Subhumans came this band called Chumbawamba. And if you haven't checked it out, be sure to check out Chumbawamba's first two albums, Pictures of Starving Children, Cell Records. And what's the second one? Oh my God, I can't remember. Because the second one, the title's in French. But I never mind the ballads. That's the second one. And those records are super unique. They're almost like World Inferno in that they're kind of like mini plays, the records. And Danbert is one of the main Chumbawamba people. He's one of the three people that started Chumbawamba. And he's co-author of the very first Clash diss song, which is kind of cool. And he threw water on the Prime Minister of England, which is pretty cool, too. And so, anyways, I'm super excited to have him play. I'm thrilled to have him play. I'm not sure if the punk scene – like, I thought all punks knew that Chumbawamba is Chumbawamba. But I'm not getting – when handing out flyers, I'm not getting the impression that people – they're like, oh, wow, Danbert. They're like, oh, wow, Chumbawamba, Tub Thumper. Yeah, I'm like, true. But there's more to him than that. So I'm not getting the impression that everyone knows who he is. Maybe they do, and maybe I'm just being an elitist. Anyways, June 1, Philadelphia, this is going to be a rocker.
So, So speaking of Crazy in the Brains, though, there's a video. You want to talk about this guy?
Yeah, okay, so Crazy in the Brains released the video. This is just John, I'm doing a soliloquy for an hour and a half.
That's okay, I'm drinking a tea that I'm really enjoying, so I'm just letting you go.
Crazy in the Brains, they've released a music video. It's off their last album, which is called Into the Ugly. I just saw Crazy in the Brains on March 22nd. Allie, maybe you can respond to this. I don't know why Crazy in the Brains aren't the most famous punk band in the world right now. Maybe it's because they're too weird, but every time I've seen them playing in front of an audience, they just rock the audience. The audience is like, oh my God, this band is amazing. And they're just getting better and better and better. I know I never shut up about them, but it's because they're so awesome. They put out a new music video. The music video is for Hot Sauce. And in the video, you need to go watch this. In the video, the band, and I actually think that's the lead singer, Chris's dad, they're kind of, I guess you would say, like a satanic ceremony or kind of a cult ceremony. And it's the song itself is kind of a slow build. And Chris like walks up to like this altar, and then the video ends with like a knife being plunged into Chris's stomach willingly by like, so he's willingly sacrificing himself in the name of something. And I think it's kind of clever. They never really reveal what. So I think this video is so well done. I think the song is fantastic. I think the album is fantastic. I think the band is fantastic. Hallie, thumbs up, thumbs down, thumbs in between. Where do you stand on Crazy in the Brains?
No, giant thumbs up. I love that band. Like I've been a fan of theirs for so long. And like, I love that they're like, you know, not to make them sound ancient, but like, I love that they're just like, they're still doing it. And while I love bands that like, try to change it up and try to change their vision or their style, like I love that Crazy in the Brain's like, they like their band. They like what they do. They like those kind of songs. They like their sound. And they just keep doing that with like total commitment and like enthusiasm. They're super creative. They're always, I don't know. They were like one of the best bands we ever had on Chris Gethard's show because they showed up and they just like got what the show was about and they figured out a way to just creatively make their set like part of our world. They're just, I think they're really, really smart, creative musicians. And yeah, this song I thought was great. I love that it's like, you know, slower than the stuff I'm used to. They're doing it's like more of like a mid-tempo song and it still comes in at around 2 minutes. I thought that was brilliant. And yeah, the video is great. The video looks great and has snakes in it. I mean, what more do you need?
Do you think they're, I mean, like Crazy in the Brain have a fan base now. They have some popularity, but they're not gigantic. Do you think they can become gigantic or this band, I think this band, and I like, let me think of the deal. Bad Cop is awesome. Crazy in the Brains is not as big as Bad Cop. I would think that Crazy in the Brains could play to kind of the same audience and that it's punk rock. It's got an edge to it, but there's an element of whimsy to it. You know what I mean? Yeah. But do you think they're too, are they too weird, do you think? Or is it just me projecting? You know what I mean?
I have no idea. I've asked myself that question. Cause like, I don't know. I feel like they played Gethard's show to a crowd of people that did not know them and everyone lost their minds. I'm with you. Anytime I've seen them play live, you can tell that they win over every person in the room. So yeah, I'm not sure why they're not, I don't think I have a good explanation for that, except that just music is weird sometimes and it doesn't, you know, it's hard to predict what's going to catch fire and what's not.
I can't wait for Dan Brett to see them because I know, I mean, coming from the Chumbawamba background, I'm sure he's going to love them. And like Dan Brett, people usually put him in like coffee house shows. He's like, came in like two other people with acoustic guitars. And I'm deliberately not putting him in that. You know what I mean? And I think it's going to blow his mind. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I don't know. Why should I care? Like if Dan Brett's mind is blown, but I care. I don't know.
You have the right motivation, John.
So anyway, a lot happening on the Philly end with regard to punk news. I'm out of control. I got to pull myself back. I've been saying I'm going to pull back after Summer Tour A3. We'll see if that holds up. I think it's got to, because I can't keep going at 110%. I got to say, well, I can, but maybe I shouldn't. You know what I mean?
I mean, you could just burst into flames, and that'd be kind of a cool way to just end the John Gentile
self-mobilization.
Yeah, we're just you finally pull it off. You book I don't know what is the peak?
Probably flag or off. Actually, yeah, at this yeah. point, so I might want
flag, you book, you know? Some sort of like off flag World Inferno joint show and
Melvin.
Yeah, you just poof and poof, you're gone. All right, so I don't want to make this all about you and your shit, but there's more of your shit that we have to get through here. So let's talk about Off.
This isn't my shit. I mean, I love this band, but it's not me.
No, it's not. But it is a band that you can talk incessantly about for 3 hours. But so here, let me read the story here. So there's somebody else making noise. So Off has gone and announced a new project, and it's a weird one. It's sort of spectacularly weird. They're making a film. The film is called Watermelon, a sci-fi punk rockumentary. It is described thusly. So this is a quote here. They said, "The movie, which began shooting in 2016, continues in Los Angeles 5 heartbreaking years after Off have disbanded." Off hasn't really disbanded. This is the fiction of the movie. Keith's hopes of landing the girl of his dreams are crushed when diabetes-induced erectile dysfunction threatens his last chance at romance. An infomercial promising powerful, long-lasting erections lures Keith down a strange path to an eccentric doctor running a brain development agency. That's just a little bit of the quote of the story of this film to really get you going here. There was another description that was on the Kickstarter page that had a little bit less erections in it. And it says here, It is a sci-fi documentary comedy that follows off through the band's breakup and reemergence as time-traveling, crime-fighting superheroes. Did you notice on the page where they're asking for money, they don't talk about Keith's dick at all?
I don't think any of this is real. Like if you watch the trailer is just about them like arguing. So I think it's like a fake documentary about the band. I don't think any of this is real at all, which is hilarious.
Well, except like they have sci-fi written all over the place. And yeah, if you look at the trailer, I've yet to see any actual evidence of the sci-fi part of this. So if you look at the trailer, it's got a whole bunch of kind of first wave punk rock super names in there. Jello's in there, Buzz Osborne, Joe Keithley from DOA, Henry Rollins. They all appear in the trailer, which you can find the trailer over at Kickstarter, where they're trying to raise money for this thing. So the Kickstarter, as we sit right now, they've raised $32,000, but they want $233,000.
What? Oh, in Canadian dollars.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. It's giving me the Canadian here. It's converted from
24
grand of 175. Yeah. All right. Now, so John, before we talk about the general wackiness of this project and whether it pleases you, and I'm sure it does, is that a worrying amount of pledge or is that pretty good?
I'm very worried. Like in my experience, most Kickstarters that fund kind of hit halfway, like the first day. Like the first day is where you're going to get most of your pledges, you know, unless it's something that goes viral. But I mean, like this started to hit everybody that it's gone. And unfortunately, that they did it. So if they don't make it, then they don't get any money. Whereas I wish they did it. If they do make it, if they don't make it, they still keep the money they've made. 25 grand off 175,000. Like if this was tickets, that's really not that great. You know what I mean?
Right. I'm worried. So if they don't make it, do they get the money?
No, and I don't get my handwritten lyric sheet signed by Keith Morris.
Well, you see, this is my selfish problem here, because if you look at the backer goals, I guess, is that what they call them, right, that you can get for this. Yeah, you can get a handwritten Keith Morris lyric sheet and something and all that. But they had a poster made for this by Raymond Pettibon of Raymond Pettibon, right? I don't even know you to do that, right? And this is just my aesthetic preference here, but I'm really into it.
Like, buy it.
I think
and
it's
help
really,
out.
Right. But I was going to, but then John, am I more into this poster or am I more into the skate deck that has this poster on it?
You're more into the poster because that will be worth more money 30 years from now. That's why. I might buy the poster too, even though I've already spent way more money on a handwritten lyric sheet than is responsible. But I want the poster too. I want everything, honestly. I want it all.
I mean, it's pretty fucking cool. I'm super into this. I mean, I love Off. Don't get me wrong. I am all supportive of them doing whatever weird project they want. But like, ever since I saw this, I've been totally like enamored with this poster. And then I was looking at the pledges and I'm like, no, I'm like, I need this to fund so I can get my fucking poster. So anyways, this is weird and interesting. Now, is there, I could have swore I saw news that there was an album that was attached to this.
That's correct. They're also releasing a quote soundtrack, which is essentially just a new Off album.
Right. So, I guess, so like, Hallie, what's your thought? Did you take a look at this, this trailer or this project in general?
I took a look at it. I'm so sad that I didn't watch the trailer because now I wish I had. I'm like, I have to say, I'm the most excited about your theory that maybe all of every single plot synopsis that they've released as part of the press for this is like not actually what the movie's about. I think that's not what I'm gunning for. I really, really want that to be the case. I think that's amazing. But yeah, I don't know. With the funding thing is so hard. Maybe not, listen, that piddly amount that they've raised, that was before this got talked about on the Punk News podcast. So maybe maybe they're going to make it to that 175 grand when this airs.
I'm worried. It's 27 days. That's a good motivator for us to actually post the podcast and not just sit on the recordings for a month, right? It's so that we can get our Kickstarter shit.
It's like a pyramid scheme that we're selling things. So I'll tell you, listen, I think this is the perfect, like, the problem that Off was facing is Off album 1, 2, and 3, they were so amazing. Like, those were some of the greatest punk rock albums ever, and it was perhaps the greatest comeback in punk rock for Keith, you know, Keith Morris. You know, Circle Jerks kind of petered out, and then he comes back with Off, which is amazing. But the problem is Off 1, 2, and 3, they're amazing records, and they all fall from each other. But Off, if they just did Off 4, it'd be like, well, here's another Off record, even if it was amazing. This is a weird, interesting, neat thing, and I think it's the right move to make. And I think the videos are just like I'm happy that Off firmly knows who they are and that they're being like goofy and funny in these videos. And these videos are like so much funnier than like so much like comedy on TV. But maybe that's just because I'm a fan. Like if you watch a video of your friends goofing around, it's hilarious. But if someone else watches it, like they're like, this isn't funny at all. So maybe that's the case here. But I am loving this. And I also love how the poster is a reference to what, Adam? What is the poster with the cut up watermelon? What is it a reference to?
Oh God, I'm blanking what it's a reference to, John.
Rolling Stone, Sticky Fingers. Nice touch, Off. Nice touch.
Wait, is it?
Yeah, the watermelon, a sci-fi, not the Raymond Pettibon poster, the one with the cut-up watermelon on it, that's using the Sticky Fingers font, and also it's got like red at the bottom, kind of like the Sticky Fingers band Swedish album cover. So that's cool.
Sorry, I was thinking of like the like the zipper album cover. That's Sticky Fingers, right?
Yeah, that's Sticky Fingers. Yeah. Well, of course, also an Andy Warhol production. And so anyways, I'm excited for this. This is going to be awesome. I really hope it funds. And I don't want Keith to suffer the mental defeat of it. Keith, I don't think I'm speaking out of school here. Keith is a very sensitive person. And he talked about this in his book. Some days he has very great days and some days he has bad days. I don't want Keith to suffer the pain of this not funding. I would make this fund for Keith is what I'm saying. And so I get my handwritten lyric sheet.
See, I'm a little bit worried that like the punks don't fund stuff.
They don't, because they're jerks.
and like on occasion it seems to work out, but whenever it's one of these older punkers, I'm worried that it's like their peer group is not hanging out on the internet doing internet stuff, and then it's not working. So like, because I'm trying to think, like, with the last music thing I funded that was successful, it would have been like Ted Leo's last record, right? So that was like a fully funded, successful, you know, the vinyl arrived, nothing got fucked up on it, Kickstarter on my end. But I remember like DOA did one for their last record, and I don't remember what the end result of it was, but it did not seem like it was doing all that well. But then they just made the record anyways. So I guess it didn't matter. I mean, maybe they set themselves up to fail by everyone knew they were going to make it anyways. But yeah, it just limped along and it made me sad. Don't know. I hope that I don't want to be sad, John. I don't want to be sad.
I don't want Keith to be sad. Do it for Keith, kids.
Do it for Adam's poster. So speaking of people who shouldn't be sad anymore, if you wanted to go to that Avail show, you have a better chance now. So their first one sold out pretty much immediately. They've added a second reunion show. This is all celebrating the 20th or 21st anniversary now. I thought it was the 20th. The 21st anniversary of the Over the James record. So the second show, it's the exact same venue. It's the following night. So the sold out one was July 19th. This one is July 20th. At the venue is called the National. It's in Richmond, Virginia, of course. And they're going to have support on the second night. Is it the same support on both nights? Can't tell.
I don't know.
The new one, the new night, the support is from Down to Nothing and Nosebleed. But, you know, if you're trying to go to a sold out reunion show, you really don't care who the support is, I suppose. So in any case, that is now available. Well, at least it is available as of us speaking about it. So it may already be sold out. John, you had an angle on this, though, that was not just Avail keeps on kicking.
Here's my angle. And the first show was overrun with ticket bots immediately, like every show is these days. And a lot of people, as with Bikini Kill and all this stuff, people end up spending 4, 5, 6 times to scalpers, which is legal now, even though I saw dudes getting arrested all the time in the 90s. But now because Ticketmaster decided it's cool, it's legal. Anyways, the point being is, so to combat that, for the second show, you had to get in line to get a ticket, which I think is a pretty good solution. But here's the thing is, are we all getting kind of out of hand with the tickets? Like, people wait in line for 6-8 hours to get tickets. Is there a certain indignity in that, that I'm so desperate to see a band for an hour that I will spend my entire day so I can spend money to see them? That is, like, I could be wrong, and I haven't firmly come up with a decision on it. Like for example, like, I wanted to go see, like, Paul McCartney, but it was $500. And I'm like, you know what? Like, I'm not so desperate that I need to spend $500 to see Paul McCartney. And maybe I'm crazy by thinking this, but, like to me, it's almost like I realize that Paul McCartney gets $500 because he's an amazing musician. He's one of the most important musicians ever. And he's entitled to it. And that the reason he's charging that much is because people will spend it. But the way I kind of saw it was like, do I think so little of myself that I'll spend $500 just to see another person? You know what I mean? And maybe that's like a crazy thought to have. I don't know. It's like, it used to be, if you want a ticket, you go to the box office and you buy a ticket. But now there's all this tiered pricing. Now you got to wait in line. You got to get a wristband. And it'd be one thing if it was like free, but you were engaging in, I guess, jumping through hoops so you can spend money so someone else can make money. Maybe I'm crazy by thinking that. To me, it just seems like the idea of punk, I guess, is, and it's kind of not true, really. But the idea is that there's no separation between the band and the person, which really is very rarely true. And these kinds of things just seem to reinforce that. Although you can't blame Avail. If people are buying tickets, what do you expect them to do? So I'm not saying Avail are being bad guys by doing this. I'm saying the current ticket buying culture, where buying tickets is a stampede, in that, like, you got to get tickets, you got to get tickets, you got to get tickets.
There might be something to the chase for people. I mean, I've never been that person, like, ever. Even when I was a teenager and I could, waste all day at the mall waiting to get into the record store and go to the fucking Ticketmaster booth and buy something, like, I was never that person. And I can't think of many times in my life where I've even, like, been the guy that's had to, like, get online and rush to the ticket seller as soon as the thing goes. I'm very laissez-faire about trying to get tickets to stuff. And so there's got to be, like, a certain degree of excitement in the chase. It's like people that go and they wait out front of a Best Buy before Black Friday so they can get in there and get, like, a cheap Nintendo or whatever they do, right? There's that aspect to it, I guess. But on the other hand, everything's gone nuts, because it was in the news in the past, 2 days, that, like, pre-sale tickets for the next Avengers movie are selling for $1,000 on eBay for a movie. John,
like, we should have bought some tickets, Adam.
Like, a movie that is the same every time it happens and is going to be in theaters for, like, months and months and months, and is, like, the biggest mass market product that you could imagine. So there's not going to be, like, it's not some art house film, right? It's a fucking Disney $1 billion blockbuster. I can't figure it out. I mean, John, I'm not being a hater. I'm going to go see this movie. I just can't understand. I can't understand we're having to rush to buy tickets like that, but then to flip them, and then who's buying them? Because someone must be buying them.
But I think you already explained it, Adam. Like, there's people for whom that's, like, that's part of it. Like, it's the, like, oh, when I was your age, we walked to school in the snow uphill both ways. You know, like, there's something about people, like, when you're that level of fan, it adds to the experience that you had to go to all these great lengths to, like, be there on the night of the premiere, or, like, even for the Avail show. I think it's just, like, people are, like, for the people who were willing to do that and for whom it was worth it, they're going to, like, love that story that they had to, like, go and they had to wait in line. It, like, proves how, like, I don't know, how committed they are to it or something. And it's, like, all, I think it all ends up being part of the experience somehow.
How am I insane by taking, I think maybe I am insane, and feel free to say I am insane. Am I insane by, like, taking this personally, like me crossing my arms, like, Paul McCartney thinks he's so good that I'll spend, you know, $500 just to see him? Well, I'm a person too, Paul. Is that an insane thought to have? Maybe it is.
Yeah, maybe a little personally.
that, yeah, that, I, that is maybe mildly insane, John. I don't know if you should try to contend with Paul McCartney or yourself all that much about it, but
if it's me or Paul, what's me or Paul? You got to make a choice.
But again, like I can understand the mindset of say the person that's going to like rush in early to get the tickets to your favorite band on their one night only performance or anything like that. But a movie, I refuse to capitulate on that one. I just don't understand. I am John. It's robots. There's robots buying the tickets and there's robots selling the tickets. It's robots all around. There isn't any human that's in that circle.
There's that analogy that came out in the 90s when like comic book speculation was a thing where people referenced back to Holland where people were speculating on roses.
Tulips.
And like people – tulips. That's tulips. Tulips. And people were like spending an insane amount of money on tulips just because there wasn't even a value. There's only perceived value and perceived value in that the value would increase. There wasn't a perception of underlying value to that extent. And that's kind of happening I guess with the movie tickets too. I mean, I'm gonna go see it, but if I can see it for $8 at the discount theater, I will.
Or like it's driving me crazy ever since I heard this story because it's not even like all that exclusive. Let's say you missed the pre-sale tickets. You can't so see the fucking Avengers at midnight, right? Well, it's not like it's gonna be sold out for weeks. You could probably go like in a couple days. And then what are you suffering then? You can't go on Reddit and get spoiled. Don't go on Reddit and get spoiled. Like go live in the world. Go to the park.
You can't like rub it in your friends' faces that like you saw it first. You were like there at the moment that everyone.
No one's doing that for a movie. I am unconvinced.
Like, you don't know enough Marvel fans.
Infinity War was really good, Adam. It was really good.
John, I mean, Hallie, I don't know your life story, so maybe I'm wrong about this, but I'm the only one that's fucking written for Marvel. I should. They didn't pay me, but that's beside the point. I did. I have the contract. And so I don't get it.
Well, would you write for Marvel? You like wrote something to the bullpen or something?
No, this is a weird punk rock connection. I interviewed Dillinger 4 and it was published on Marvel.com. And they were going to start doing these series of like talking to musicians about comic books. And I had to sign like the fucking writer's contract like a real writer. And I was going to get paid $30 and John, they stiffed me.
Adam, you could have spun that into you could have been writing Spider-Man by now, Adam.
John, hey. I just wanted a check with Spider-Man on it, but it never showed up. So and they've redesigned their website since, so the article's gone, so I can't even at least go, you know, my name is there. Like I have nothing to show for it at all except a contract that is in a file folder in my basement. well, you know, yeah, that's just how it goes. Someone play a song because I'm sad now.
Allie, hit us with a jam.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, so I'm trying to make up for the fact we the last time I was on, we talked about you know, trying to like plug and support like smaller bands and how awesome a thing that is to do on smaller labels, and then I went and like played like a song by like Connor Oberst's new project. So I'm trying to redeem myself. I like this one. It's this band. I believe they're from Australia. They're called An Horse, right? So like instead of a horse, like An Horse. And this single is called "This Is a Song." I like it for two reasons. Well, I like it for a lot of reasons, but the two that I'm going to talk about are that it has a great catchy chorus that you cannot argue with. That is just. It's just a syllable. I think it's just woes, which is like that I have, I think 50% of my songs, I didn't actually write words to the chorus. They're just like a syllable. So I'm super into that style of songwriting. Also, this is coming out on Lame-O Records out of Philly. And I think that's a great label. That's a label that's been like super nice to like my bands and a lot of bands that I know. And so, yeah, so I think this song is catchy as hell. And yeah, it's Ann Horse with This Is a Song.
John, there's a Fest lineup.
Yes.
Let's not bury the lead here. So the Jawbreaker is headlining Fest 18. That's the that is the long and short of it. That I think is all that everyone focused in on there. Although there's other cool things that are on that on the lineup. So this is the first a lineup confirmation. They usually go through two or three rounds of this. They have alluded that the further confirmations are going to be of equal import this time. So it's not going to be like, here's all the big bands and then here's, you know, here's a bunch of people that are playing bars 3 miles out of downtown. It's actually like the next one is supposed to be also big. So anyways, Jawbreaker is on this. Less Than Jake, a reunion of Jawbox. You got Dag Nasty playing it. Mariachi El Bronx, Off With Their Heads, AJJ, Iron Reagan, Joyce Manor, Teenage Bottle Rocket. And then we get into the small text, so there's a whole hell of a lot more on here. Just to rifle.
Tsunami Bomb, Screaming Females!
Yeah, in that voice. the copyrights, Kepi Ghuli, No Trigger, Tim Barry, Planes Mistaken for Stars, Spanish Love Songs, who else is on here? There's lots.
I think they put Screaming Females way too low. I think Screaming Females is way, you know, bigger than that.
I would make Screaming Females a bolder one, but I'm a fan, so I don't know. So anyways, there's a whole bunch of stuff that is playing this festival. So this year it is same weekend as usual, not technically on Halloween. So November 1, 2, 3 is when it's happening down in Gainesville, as always. They didn't publish anything in particular about the pre-fest yet, if that's happening. I assume it's happening. The past couple of years, they've done some events in the days leading up to Fest in Ybor City. but those are not yet known. So in any case, this is Fest. This is the 18th year of Fest. And there you go. That's lineup. Any thoughts or is that a lineup?
I mean, I'm excited for Fest because Jawbreaker, that's like a big get for Fest. I mean, obviously they get great bands every year, but am I wrong? That seems like a different,
it seems like a bigger than usual get. I think I agree.
Right? Yeah. Like I'm excited for Tony and those guys that run that festival. I think that's rad. And I'm bummed that I probably won't go this year. And I've been like, of those 18 years, I think I've been like probably half of those years.
You have good reason probably for not going.
I do. I'm about to have a baby. Although we got the baby, those headphone things.
Oh, all right. See, I haven't gotten any of those for my kids yet, but I have need of them.
The first thing that I registered for, but that was literally the first thing. I was like, that baby's going to need those like crazy, like headphone things for ear protection.
They're like the size of a globe split.
Yeah,
in half.
For yeah. Sure. So yeah, I don't know. Maybe we'll see. We'll see. Maybe we'll make it down there.
I am. I mean, like given some of the sad news on punk news this week, and a lot of the old crew is kind of like, come back out of the ether and reminisced a little bit about some past fests that we've been to. And it has made me nostalgic. It makes me want to go to this. The lineup is cool, but they're gonna be wrong, but yeah, you know, I would love to get down there and kind of like get in the mix with that crowd. But the most old man reaction I had to this was that I saw it and I thought to myself, oh, that Jawbreaker show will be busy. Like this, like that was my Debbie Downer read on the whole thing was like, oh, think of how you get into that one. That's a line right there. Oof. But I probably shouldn't think like that because it's a horrible way to live. So
you really, we're learning about you how much you hate standing in line.
I guess.
There's been a lot of anti-line.
This is just like all my negativity about queuing up somewhere is just creeping out. Although I mean, like again, seeing Jawbreaker at Fest is totally different than getting a movie ticket. Anyways, but there's gonna be a lot more Fest stuff that's coming out in the next little while. Moving on, John, there's a fucked up video. There's a new one.
Yes, Funk Up has released a new video. It's somewhat, I guess, more stripped back. Of course, they put out an album called Dosha Dreams late last year. It was amazing. Double disc. The big thing of the album was in that, well, the theme of the band is the conflict between Damien and Mike. And I've interviewed both Damien and Mike. Mike says there's not really a conflict. That's a fictionalization created by the press. And Damien says, there's always a huge conflict that we often hate each other. So who knows what the truth is? The theme of this album was that for the first time ever, Damien was kind of stepping back and letting Mike just do whatever he does. And Damien was going to contribute to it. And the result was an album that was this album. I don't know if Chemistry of Common Life is my favorite effed up album or this one, but it's definitely one of the two. This one was a little bit more further out. And the listeners know I love far out albums. And this album is great and far out. The video, I think it's probably the last in the line. It's usually the video a label will put out, you know, a couple of months after the album's been out to, you know, get a little bit of interest out of the album, to reignite a little bit more interest from the album and then, to kind of make the last few sales, if you will. The video is cool. It follows the characters that we've seen in the Dosha Dreams album. And cool thing about F'd Up is everything fits together from the music videos to the album to the inserts to the T-shirts they put out. It all fits together as kind of one big multimedia art project, which is really cool. Here's the question. I F'd Up admittedly was disappointed with the reaction from Glass Boys. It didn't sell a ton of records. Reviews were generally positive, but I think that's because David Come to Life was so massive that you often see that is if a band puts out a landmark album, the next album is either smashed or, yeah, it's pretty good. I think Glass Boys got kind of a muted reception. No one said they hated it, but no one's like, oh my God, this is the album. So when this album came out, I think the bands were hoping to say, this will be effed up, you know, rising to the occasion again, making something far out and blowing people's mind. Critical opinion of this album was wildly positive. Wildly positive. It was huge. All the critics myself included, said, this album is amazing, daring, clever, unique, and awesome. Like, everyone from Rolling, actually, except Rolling Stone dissed it for some reason. And actually, Corey Gow, the writer who I know is a nice guy, he dissed it. And I had no idea why he did. Aside from Rolling Stone, you know, Pitchfork, Noisy, Punk News, Consequence and Sound, Anthony Fantano, everybody said it was great. Everybody, right? However, I don't know if sales were that great in that they put out a limited, nicer version and then a regular version. The limited, nicer version you can still buy, meaning it didn't sell out. So I don't know. Did the band achieve what they were hoping to achieve? Did they blow everyone's mind? Is this kind of the album that kind of gave them another shot in the arm, as this band has historically required, you know, here and there to, you know, come back in full force? Or are we, and maybe we're not, are we kind of at the precipice of a slow teeter to an end, or maybe a lull or something like that? What I'm saying is the album was awesome. Everyone that heard it thought it was awesome. I don't, and I could be wrong, it doesn't seem like sales were that stellar.
Yeah, I'm wondering what if it would have been different if this had been the follow-up to David Comes to Life.
Ah!
Don't you feel like that would have just been a totally different situation? Like, because I sort of feel like the fact that people didn't love that, the follow-up to David Comes to Life, and then that so many years have passed and that people have maybe heard, you know, people that follow them maybe have heard that the band doesn't get along so well anymore. You know, I wonder if this had come out right on the heels of that other release, if it would just have been like this artsy hardcore snowball, like rolling down the hill. You know, I think it could have been like received differently by like, yeah, obviously it was received really well by critics, and I think rightfully so, but I think you're right. It does seem like there's been like a little bit of a disconnect with how it's been received, but like actually by music fans.
I feel like somehow their narrative started working against them, and I'm not sure why. Because to me, the conflict between Damien and Mike has always been it's been interesting. Like the fact that this band has seemed at times in the past that it's not that it's fracturous, that it's making like, they're making amazing art somehow despite, or maybe because of, all of the big personalities in this band that are butting into each other and are challenging each other. So I look at it and I take this like very like Beatles standpoint on it, where I'm like, cool. Like that's like, I like that. Like I'm okay with, like, I don't have any emotional investment in the band being friends with each other. So if they're all gonna, you know, come together every 4 or 5 years, almost murder each other, but then through that conflict, you know, birth something really cool and interesting, then like as a music fan, I'm all for it. Like I don't you know, I want people to be happy, but I don't care if they're not happy when making it from a critical standpoint. And that's always been my opinion. And it's because these like the talk of the turmoil within Fucked Up has like always been there. But what in the lead up to this, there were a few interviews that I feel that Damien gave that sounded more, I don't know, like he sounded more dour on what was going on. It made it sound like he was being forced out, I think, more than maybe the reality of that was. And I saw a lot of people that were like quoting those, or like sharing the links to those interviews on Twitter or whatever, and commenting that like, oh, this is bumming me out, or I'm worried about this, or whatever. And I was just reading it as like the normal push and pull and insecurities that sort of drive Fucked Up. But I feel like a lot of people weren't taking it that way, and they were taking it as like, you know, oh, this is something I should be concerned about. So like, I wonder if it like, I don't know, like harshed their vibe or something with some chunk of the audience. And if that's the case, that's super disappointing, because like, I'm still so into this record. I'm so into everything about it. Before this album came out, Owen Pallett, violin player, he plays under the name Final Fantasy. He does most of the strings on Fucked Up Records. He was commented before anyone had heard anything from it, that this is the band's Screamadelica. Like, mm-hmm. like likening this record to what Primal Scream did there, where just, you know, they had done a certain amount. Yeah, you know, they had certain inklings in their sound, but this is the one where they just like blew it up and went crazy with it and took it to its logical extremes and whatever. And the song "Dose Your Dreams" in particular that this video is for is that to me. Like, and I'm so. Like, I'm so into it. I'm into even this low budgety video that they've made for it, where you have Mike and Jonah Falco just like just dancing around and being weird and really owning the fact that it's their vocals that are at the fore of this particular song. And even though this is not a song that is like completely upfront led by Damien, I really love how Damien is used in this song. And to listen to this, to like to this piece of music and go like I don't see it as Damien being pushed out. I see them as using him as an instrument, maybe a little bit more sparingly, but maybe by doing that, allowing them to compose something like this that wouldn't have fit on something like Glass Boys. Like, that all seems great to me. So, like, I'm down with this song and this record and this video and everything. So, yeah, if it's not working for people, I don't know.
I don't know. Who is this record not working for? Like, I'm with everything you just said. I think the album's so amazing. I'm sort of just like, now I'm just sort of like thinking out loud, but I'm wondering if. Because I love also that you don't care if they get along or not, because I think that's how it should be. Like, I, you know, like, why should we need them to be, you know, like besties?
Yeah, like, I don't wish them strife.
Why should we need them to be like driving yeah. around in their like tour bus, like listening to John Denver and being, you know, I do think, especially with punk and hardcore, that people do have this like a little, they're kind of sticklers about like, needing it to be like they need like the artist to be doing it for the right reason. And so I'm wondering, is there any aspect of it where it's like, if we've heard so much about how these people don't like each other, do you then start to question, well, then like, why are you still doing this? And are there some people that are like seeing it as a, I'm just sort of thinking out loud, but like, are there people that are seeing it as like a money grab or like, I don't know. What do you think?
The criticism that makes sense to me is the criticism that I feel like they've always would have had, which is like the hardcore guy criticism. And you definitely could see that, like, if you went and there was some great shade that was thrown at this record by it was like some hardcore blogger that I stumbled upon, where they went and they reviewed one of the secret side project bands from this session. It was the it was a Japanese hardcore styled one, John.
Agizum? Zao?
No. The fucked up side project band that was playing in the Japanese hardcore style, though.
Oh, Woodbury Angelico.
Woodbury or whatever it was, right? So this hardcore blog went and reviewed that record and like conspicuously didn't mention this one at all in the review. But in a way that was like just digging the knife in, where it was just, you know, we're like, we're not even going to dignify the non-hardcore shit that this band is putting out. And we're going to do that by super praising this really hardcore thing that they've put out. And but I get that, because I get why, like, if you are like a meat and potatoes hardcore dude, you know, you don't want to hear them playing like weird indie rock and dancing around in an alleyway. Like, I get that, but I feel like that's not the brunt of the pushback or whatever. I don't know. I have no read on it other than that. Because that's a Tom Trauma pushback, right? I don't think Tom liked this when we were all hyping it up, but I kind of get why Tom doesn't like this. Because, like, Tom's like an old school punk rock guy. He doesn't want to listen to this goofy dance music. And I get that. Like, that's cool. But, like, again, like, I don't feel like those are the guys that didn't show up to the party. I don't know.
It's the indie guys that didn't show up for some reason. That's what
I think that's it. Right. And so, yeah. the, and the, what do they do to tick the indie guys off? Because, but it might just be that the indie guys are fickle.
Yeah, well,
I keep using guys here, and I'm trying not to make this as gendered as I'm making it sound. But like the you know, the you said Pitchfork reviewed it well, and they did. But were the Pitchfork, is the Pitchfork universe, were they enthusiastic about this? And maybe they weren't. And that I don't know.
Yeah, like, did they go, are they like, oh, I went through that thing where I was like humoring like hardcore. Like I went through that phase. Like, I don't, you know, me, something where, yeah, like, yeah, like a fickleness, like you're saying.
Yeah, I don't know. Indie people. So anyways, we're gonna get right back off this and make the punkers happy and talk about the Dead Kennedys for a sec. John, what's the story here? Three live albums coming out. Well, why would anyone complain? Why isn't this great?
Dead Kennedys are releasing a three CD set. It's live. It's three live albums. It's the two famous bootlegs, the Paradiso bootleg and the very famous Skateboard Party bootleg and the Farm bootleg. Both Paradiso and Skateboard Party are from Plastic Surgery Disasters. The Farm is from Frankenchrist, the album, that era. All three track listings are very different. And I've heard these releases, and it appears they did come from the bootleg source. That being said, the Dead Kennedys organization did it right, at least in the release of it, of the material, and that they really cleaned it up. And these sound basically like officially recorded live albums. They sound really good. The band is on, especially Skateboard Parties. Skateboard Party is probably the best officially released Dead Kennedys live album there is, because, well, there's three now, I guess. There's the first one, which is Mutiny on the Bay, which is okay. Live to Death Club, which is fantastic, but that's a very early incarnation of Dead Kennedys. And then now this one with three CDs, and it sounds great. But I mean, of course, the Dead Kennedys battle, it's raging as it ever has been. Of course, as the listeners know, the Dead Kennedys are split between two camps. On one camp is Jello Biafra, on the other camp is East Bay Ray, Clouds, and DH Peligro. And of course, this release is being released, of course, by East Bay Ray, DH, and Clouds. And of course, Jello doesn't want it to be released because Jello sees it as cheapening the legacy of the band, as he sees the Dead Kennedys touring without him as cheapening the legacy of the band. I interviewed East Bay Ray about this, and we'll be running that pretty soon at Punk News. I talked to Adam about this, about the interview prior to the podcast. Adam, you remember that conversation. And so it sounds good, but the question is, should they put this out? Is it cool? Or is it cool and just giving fans something that they want because it does sound good? Or is it Jello's on it, but it's being released without his consent? So is that in poor taste? Well,
I'm actually chewing on this because we just talked about, you know, everybody in Fucked Up not getting along and how I don't seem to care too much about that. There is some arbitrary line I kind of want to draw where I want to say that, like, if the singer on something does not want it out, I give that a little bit more weight than not. And I don't know why, but the horse has kind of left the barn on the rights to a lot of this Dead Kennedys stuff. So given that we're not going to make everybody happy with each other, and given that, you know, we're not going to put all the rights back into the hands of I don't want to sound like I'm taking a side. I don't want to say like, oh, Jello should have all these rights. It's not what I'm trying to say. What I'm trying to say is, like, there's no way that the rights situation is going to be non-contentious, right? So given that, and that, so something is going to end up coming out. Live, well-sounding live records from the band's heyday seems like the least gross option. You know, if you have to have something, doing endless, unnecessary greatest hits sets would be gross. Just recording more stuff in the Black Flag realm of things would be gross. So, you know, if they're gonna put out something, you know, you could you could probably hold your nose about the right situation and listen to one of these and get to enjoy a really cool, you know, early 80s Jello performance. So I guess that's something. I'm trying to make lemonade here, John.
What was Jello's it's a rights dispute, or like what was his actual stance and why he didn't want this to come out?
Here's his stance as it is with all. So Dead Kennedy stuff used to be released on Alternative Tentacles. Jello and the other three Dead Kennedys got in a big legal fight that lasted years. The end result was the quote Dead Kennedys, which is East Bay Ray Clowes and DH1, Jello lost. So at the end of the lawsuit, they each had one voting share, if you will. So the three band together, and so Jello always gets outvoted in any decision, to the point where anything that Dead Kennedys does is arbitrary about having a vote, because Jello's going to lose every time. So the reason Jello doesn't want this out, I mean, his official response is, it wasn't, these weren't recorded to be live recordings. Therefore, the quality isn't something the fans should get. Therefore, you are being ripped off. And because it doesn't have the authorization of all four Dead Kennedys, it's technically a bootleg. However, I think I would assume that in reality, the reason it doesn't want it out is because he's not part of the decision-making process. And he doesn't want the people that hate him and that he hates to profit off his work, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah, that's tricky.
I agree with Adam's stance in that I usually take the position, if an artist doesn't want it out, then don't put it out. The artist should be the ultimate arbiter of his own material or her own material. That being said, I don't think that's an absolute rule, in that if something really reflects good upon the artist and isn't a cash out and is something fans would really enjoy and think better of the artist, then I think it should come out. And especially Skateboard Party here, it's a marvelous live record. So even though it's kind of a bummer that Jello's not happy, and I can understand that, I'm glad this is coming out, because I've had the Skateboard Party bootleg for years and it's great. And the newer version sounds really good. And so as a fan, like anything that's here's a great contrast. The Dead Kennedys, just about 6 months ago, 5 months ago, released the quote demos from before the first album, and it was terrible. The sound quality is so bad. Like they sold it as a $20 record. They should have given away as a free download, because the sound quality is just atrocious. It's like this is clearly a bootleg recording. You can barely hear it, and basically you rip me off. And it doesn't give you any insight into the band. It just it's a curio, but it doesn't need to be a product or something people spend money for. By contrast, this is something that's really cool and does make the band look better, and does show how fiery they were in the live context. Because aside from Live at the Death Club, which is a very early live record, we don't have any record of the Dead Kennedys live. And reportedly, they were awesome live. And this live album demonstrated that they were. So, you know, if they could all get along, they could. But the fact of the reality is they can't. This makes everybody look good from an artistic standpoint, so I say put it out.
Mm-hmm. Oh, John, there's so much history in the Punk News universe of this Dead Kennedys fight, and it's just, you know, I feel like the horse feels like it's left the barn on so much of it that yeah, I'm looking at it and going, if these are things that were going to be available as bootlegs anyways, I mean, I guess having a nice official-ish version of them is not the worst thing. I don't know. All right, John, let's do one last before we wrap it up here.
Here's where Adam solves the Palestine-Israeli conflict. Take it away, Adam.
Anyways, no. So here we go. One last story. So we had a dictator story here. So. Dick Manitoba of the Dictators, he was hosting a radio show on the Sirius XM satellite thing for about 10 years, until last year, when the program was suddenly ended. In a 7-minute video, Manitoba explained what happened. In brief, he had political disagreements with some Sirius employee, who that employee happened to be a supporter of Palestine. Although he does not detail his own views, he intimates that he had different viewpoints than this person. And then this is where it gets more iffy. Then Manitoba drew a Star of David with either a Sharpie or a highlighter on the employee's desk, and this bit of provocation led to his firing. So he said that he's now basically starting a podcast in the similar vein to his radio show. So, I mean, on behalf of podcasting, Dick, welcome. In any case, the show is called You Don't Know Dick, and you can find his full spiel about this in the linked video over on Punk News. John, what are we to make of this?
Well, listen, it's been a rough couple of years for Handsome Dick Manitoba. A few years ago, he was arrested for domestic assault. I don't know if he was ever charged with anything, but he was arrested. So you can take from that what you will. And of course, he's been in for years and years. He was the guy that wrote the Dictator songs is Andy Chernoff. And for years and years, Handsome Dick Manitoba and Andy Chernoff, much like effed up, they didn't like each other, but they got along enough to record music together. But it hit ahead about 6 years ago. Andy Chernoff sued Dick Manitoba, and the result was Dick Manitoba may no longer be the Dictator. Now he's just called Manitoba. And so the two main dictators, Handsome Dick Manitoba and Andy Chernoff, hate each other. Also, Dick Manitoba almost lost his bar a couple of years ago because he didn't have a handicap access. And from Dick Manitoba's argument is he got sued by a guy that was handicapped. But the only reason that guy was suing him was not because he wanted to go to the bar, just because he wanted to make some easy money. I'm not going to argue on behalf of either side of that. And everything Dick is involved in, Adam and Hallie, it's very messy. It's never a clean cut. You know what I mean? So with this one, it's like the story is this: the dictators come from the before the first wave of punk. They were deliberately provocative. They had songs like the Master Race Rock, and of course the joke is the Master Race, of course, being Nazis. The joke being, of course, Handsome Dick Manitoba is of Jewish background, as are several other dictators. They had a couple other, I guess, what you would call semi-offensive songs from back in the day. Back in the mid-70s, it was fine to be, I mean, it was considered fine to be offensive. Many of those artists, you know, Patti Smith, Lou Reed, they used the N-word. Not necessarily in a, well, I'm not even going to get into it. You can look into that yourself. You know what I'm saying? None of this is all very, very messy. The point being is they come from a time where you can say nasty things and it didn't really negatively affect you. 2019 is not that way. Handsome Dick Manitoba's problem is he's still Handsome Dick Manitoba from 1975, but it's 2019. And you could take one stance and say, that's because Handsome Dick Manitoba is right and people are too sensitive these days and people aren't really offended, but they're using offensiveness as a weapon to strike out people they don't look like. Or the other counterattack is Handsome Dick, you didn't evolve with the times. Everyone else, you know, even Johnny Ramone, famously conservative, kind of, you know, realized times were changing and changed how he expressed himself. You know, John Lennon, Jello, you know, realized times were changing and changed certain things. Slayer even changed certain things. Handsome Dick Manitoba stoutly refused to do so, saying that, people are destroying, you know, language or freedom of speech. We've argued this many times. I'm not going to get into that argument. It's all very messy. So where am I going with this? Here's what I think happened. I think Handsome Dick and this, and I don't know. I think some people are very good at poking the beast, but only poking the beast where they're legally entitled to poke the beast. Whereas the beast getting poked sometimes strikes out and crosses the line. And were that person more calculating, they would realize that don't cross the line. First of all, why is Handsome Dick even getting involved? Listen, you got a radio show at SiriusXM, show up. If someone's being an asshole to you, say, I don't care, I got a radio show to do. Say whatever you want. I don't give a shit. I'm on the radio. You can say whatever you want. Doesn't bother me. But of course, that's what it comes down to. Handsome Dick could have played this better, people. He should have just ignored the person or whatever. That being said, is drawing a Star of David on someone else's desk offensive? That's a good question, isn't it? Because I mean, hypothetically, Star of David in itself isn't offensive, but that's a great question. Hey, it goes to the Israeli-Palestine conflict. Like, if I drew a cross on someone's desk, is that offensive? If someone drew a satanic star on my desk, is that offensive? I don't know. You know, I mean,
it's not the symbol in isolation. It's the fact that
that's a good point.
I'm going to look at this as an employer. if I have two employees and they are fighting over anything, let alone the fucking Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and their way of well, first of all, this is affecting their work performance and their chipping at each other in weird shit ways, like drawing symbols on each other's desks. At that point, you have an HR problem that exists above and beyond anyone's political opinion.
You know, I get the opinion. It was at this point, Sirius realized, you know what? Handsome Dick is more trouble than he's worth. He's not bringing us that much money in, so let's get rid of him. That's how I read it.
Yeah, that's my read.
Yeah, I just also wonder, you know, like, it just makes you wonder if there's not just slightly more to the story. Because I will say, somehow it really, like, really, really breaks my heart to think of, like a sick... I don't need to paint him like, you know, he's, you know, like, pathetic or something. Hearing that a 65-year-old person has lost their job, like, that, my heart, like, kind of can't take that. And it doesn't totally seem to me. I mean, he definitely crossed the line. And he talks in that video about how much he loved the job at Sirius. And you can't help but be like, well, then why did you do this, man? Because it isn't like this other employee was confronting him with her support of Palestine. She just apparently, in her personal space at her desk, had stuff that made it very clear what her opinions are on that conflict. And he kind of went into her workspace and kind of, you know, like, yeah, wrote the, but it, you know, it's kind of, to me, it's just sort of like a juvenile way to handle having a difference of an opinion with someone. I don't totally know that, like, it's worth firing someone, like, and yeah, again, like, especially when they're an older person. It makes me wonder if there wasn't maybe just a little bit more to the story. Like, if maybe once he was asked to apologize, you know, I don't know, but maybe he could have handled the aftermath a little bit better or something. It just feels to me like maybe there was a little bit something more there.
Hallie, I like how you state that. Like, it said like a 65-year-old guy losing his job. And one of the things he's like, I went to work for 10 years and I wasn't ever late one day. And that's such like an old school work mentality, you know, like this isn't like, I worked in a produce market for 14 years, you know, and people are late a lot. But yeah, like, if you're a dependable produce market employee, you show up on time every day. But when you get involved in, like, I'll also call it like a New York job, you know, if you work in insurance, if you're an attorney, like, there's not really an on time in the morning because, like, your salary. So it's not like you're clocking in. But it's such an old school mentality of Dick is like, I clock in on time every day when he doesn't even have that kind of a job. You know what I mean? Which is interesting. Man, poor Dick's got a lot of problems, man.
All right. So we'll wrap up here and we'll play something else on the way out. If anyone wants to send us email, it is podcast@punknews.org is how you do that. Hallie, but before we're gone, you have anything that you want to plug or let people know about?
I will just say, like, it was really hard for me to pick a song to play this week because I just heard so much good stuff when I was like rooted, when I was like thinking about what I wanted to play. It was like, so I'll just say, yeah, I'm just like, I'm loving all the new like X-Hex stuff that just came out, and I'm loving this. I didn't know this band Control Top. They've got a new album coming out that I'm like pretty excited about. And yeah, I don't know, just that, lots of good music. Oh, I love this single called Walkie Talkie by this band Wand that's on Jag City. It's like, I don't know. But if you're in the mood for like more new music, those were the things that I was really excited about this week.
All right, John, you wanna play something at the end here, or?
I'll play. Let's see here. I'll play some Quam. Quam playing the Punk News Prom on May 4 in Philadelphia. Quam, Joel Tannenbaum, and two more bands that I haven't gotten yet, and I'm getting real close to the deadline, so I need to get locked up real soon. But this is May 4, Philadelphia. Quam from NYC.